hormones again. Headlines are meant to catch the eye, but they risk imprinting misinformation in the mind. The Journal of Women's Health also published an article using data from the Nurses' Health Study. Although one should not necessarily judge an article by where it appears, there is a pecking order in clinical medicine. The New England Journal of Medicine and the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, are the alpha roosters. In my own specialties, the Annals of Internal Medicine, Blood, and the Journal of Clinical Oncology are the most prestigious. When researchers have rigorous, groundbreaking data to announce, they try to publish in one of the top-tier journals. By the same token, these journals seek out epical reports to add to their luster. The Women's Health Initiative and the HERS study were published, respectively, in the New England Journal of Medicine and JAMA. The earlier papers from the Observational Nurses' Health Study appeared in these journals as well. But as it became clear that self-reporting and other biases seriously limited the nurses' study, its credibility declined. The media are hungry to pursue topics that are not only controversial, but draw in readers with desirable demographics. Hormone replacement therapy is sure to find an eager audience with disposable income. Journalists accurately reported the information in the news articles. Women who started hormone therapy right after menopause reduced their risk of coronary heart disease by about 30%. This observation led to the hypothesis that estrogen might best be used in women in their early 50s, at the onset of menopause, and that the average age of the participants in the Women's Health Initiative, 64, could account for the failure of estrogen to protect their hearts. The articles revealed a subtle insight into the culture of medicine. Where you stand depends on where you sit. Your specialty can affect, even determine, your position. In this case, gynecologists and cardiologists came out on different sides. Some gynecologists, who are often the primary care physicians for women, and who had prescribed estrogen as a mainstay of their practice for decades, rushed to embrace the new data from the Nurses' Health Study, even while acknowledging that they were not definitive. Dr. Mary Jane Minkin, a clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Yale, told the New York Times, "Personally, in my heart of hearts, I think there is a benefit." Dr. Minkin disclosed that she was a consultant and paid speaker for drug companies that made estrogen, and she took the hormone herself. Delgado likened Minkin's remarks to Dr. Foyer's. "She is a believer, too." Delgado thought it unlikely that Minkin's belief was based on money. But was it based on science? For a patient to hear that a professor at a prestigious medical school like Yale believes, in my heart of hearts, in a treatment so strongly that she takes it herself, that has a powerful impact. "I didn't think these doctors are prostituting themselves for the drug companies," Delgado said. "Rather, they are speaking not objectively, but from faith. It is not uncommon to find such believers among physicians." Many readers do not go beyond an article's headline or its opening paragraph. It is also difficult for laymen to critically assess statements coming from apparent voices of authority. For example, toward the end of the Times article, Dr. Frederick Naftalin, a retired chairman of the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at Yale, disputed the data from the Women's Health Initiative study as counterintuitive. "The relationship between the fall in estrogen and the rise in cardiovascular disease in women is incontrovertible," Dr. Naftalin said. "So why in the world would you not try to find out whether simply maintaining estrogen at the levels of reproductive life could be cardioprotective?" In response, cardiologists argue that this theory has been discredited. "Atherosclerosis starts well before the age of menopause," said Dr. Deborah Grady, a principal investigator in the HERS trial. "On top of that, why would you want a preventive intervention that has a lot of other side effects like blood clots? These people have a theory they don't want to give up on, no matter what. Dr. Richard M. Fuchs, a cardiologist and clinical professor of medicine at Weill Medical College in New York, echoed this view. There is no good evidence that hormone therapy reduces the risk of heart disease. And there is reasonable evidence to say it increases heart disease and stroke, pulmonary embolism, and breast cancer, Dr. Fuchs said. My advice is all women should try to get off it. It didn't make sense that nature could be so wrong, Delgado said, talking about the steady decline in hormone levels in women after menopause. It didn't make sense that every woman should be on the same medication. You have to look at each patient as an individual and assess what is best as a preventive. A one-size-fits-all approach to prescriptions was flawed. Although Delgado felt vindicated by the Women's Health Initiative, the NIH-sponsored trial of hormones versus placebo in postmenopausal women, it seemed like common sense to her that a single hormone could not return a woman to biological youth. Delgado does not consider the Women's Health Initiative an absolute condemnation of estrogen. She still treats women who she believes might benefit from hormonal treatment. You have to weigh the information, she told me. You assess the risks and then make a trade-off. For example, she had recently seen a woman entering menopause with incapacitating hot flashes, whose mother had had breast cancer. Estrogens are known to promote cancer of the breast, and such a family history is cause for concern. But the woman had such severe symptoms that she could not work or socialize. I recommended she take estrogen to tide her through this period, Delgado said. She explained in detail to the patient the trade-offs involved before recommending the hormone treatment, emphasizing that breast cancer could develop even with close monitoring. Furthermore, she hoped that the hormone could soon be discontinued. It wasn't an easy decision, not a simple trade-off, but such choices rarely are simple. So, for women like this, with severe acute symptoms of menopause, Delgado prescribes estrogen for short periods until the change of life passes. Then, unless there is a clear need for continued treatment and no alternative, she stops. Hormones are not the fountain of youth, Delgado said, no matter how they are depicted by the media and some physicians. To believe that a hormone like estrogen can prevent most of the consequences of aging, such as heart disease and memory loss, simply makes no sense, she told me. The biology of aging involves many physiological systems, changes in many molecules. Fixating on a single molecule like estrogen as a remedy is naive and, as the Women's Health Initiative study showed, potentially dangerous. There is a powerful temptation felt by patients and doctors alike to have a simple answer to complicated problems, Delgado concluded. Douglas Watson was an executive in the pharmaceutical industry for 33 years, rising to be the president and CEO of Novartis Corporation, the U.S. subsidiary of Swiss-based Novartis AG. I spoke with Watson to gain the perspective of an experienced pharmaceutical executive whom I knew to be ethical and data-driven. Watson hails from Scotland and has the straight-talking, direct manner that characterizes so many of his countrymen. He studied pure mathematics at Cambridge University in the United Kingdom and then rose through the ranks of large pharmaceutical companies until his early retirement from Novartis in 1999. Watson had once made a statement that caught my attention. If a new drug signals a significant improvement, either in its efficacy against a clinical condition or in its safety profile, with fewer side effects, then statistical gymnastics should not be needed to persuade a doctor to try it. My goal in terms of marketing is to have a physician try a new therapy in one or two of his patients. And I mean one or two. Not in hundreds, he told me. We would want the physician to have a positive experience with the drug, to see its benefits for these one or two patients. That way, he would become comfortable in learning how to use it appropriately, and incorporate it into his standard of care. Watson said marketing studies show that most physicians routinely prescribe only around 24 drugs, and that the majority of these drugs were adopted during their medical training or shortly thereafter, even if that training occurred decades earlier. Most practicing doctors like to feel in control of their treatments, and that sense of control is derived from long-term experience with a particular drug. In fact, there often is no need to prescribe the latest drug for hypertension or arthritis, for example, because most new therapies for these maladies are either me-too agents that are substantially similar to their predecessors, or they represent only a small increment in benefit rather than a marked advance. There may be one or two generations of products that offer marginal improvement, my words for these kinds of new drugs, but the experienced clinician rightly relies on his golden oldies and still delivers appropriate care. Watson laughed. I can see two perspectives on this. As a businessman, it can drive you nuts because I want to sell you a product. But, as a patient myself, it makes perfect sense, because usually I don't need the latest and greatest drug to improve my health. Patients' satisfaction with the relief they get from arthritic pain with anti-inflammatory agents is very low, Watson continued, a subject, Jerry, that I know is close to your heart. He was familiar with my long-standing difficulties with low back pain. When a new arthritis drug is developed, there is a very rapid penetration of the market, because people say, what I'm on now isn't doing a very good job, so I may as well give this new drug a try. Usually, within 6 months, Watson said, nearly the entire market share that this new anti-arthritic agent will capture has been captured. Everyone and their sister run down the road to their doctor and say, I saw this ad on the TV for Celebrex or Vioxx. And, Watson continued, the doctor, aware that the patient's arthritis was not being meaningfully ameliorated, is ready to prescribe the new drug. If the advertisement were for a blood pressure medication, then, Watson said, today's drugs, not to mention yesterday's drugs, control blood pressure quite well for the vast majority of people. So a doctor is less willing to try a new agent, even if a patient requests it. Watson sees testosterone replacement therapy as an example, like Viagra, where the pharmaceutical industry is capitalizing on a cultural shift. Sexual function was not a dinner table conversation when I was growing up, he said. Even 20 years ago, I am not sure that you would have seen the social expectations around sex being what they are today. Testosterone, Viagra, and other drugs being prescribed are driven by the change in society, and men's usage overall has very little association with the word need. Watson admits with a laugh that when Viagra was in development, he didn't realize its full potential. He had in mind the relatively small number of men who'd had damage to the nerves of their penis or had pelvic radiation or surgery. He did not anticipate the large numbers of men who would take the drug, not for such a clear medical indication, but recreationally. Who would have predicted that Bob Dole gets on the TV and talks about it? The ads featuring Dole, in Watson's view, caused a dramatic change in the public and a ripple effect among physicians, resulting in Viagra's multi-billion-dollar revenues. If a respected war hero from Kansas, whose politics were generally conservative, with a dynamic, glamorous wife, could advocate such a drug, then anyone could feel comfortable using it to improve his own sex life. The major difference between testosterone and drugs like Viagra is that Viagra produces a clear physical result, a sustained erection, while the studies on testosterone often show no enhanced libido compared with a placebo. When I asked Watson for his definition of ethical marketing of drugs, he replied that the primary aim of marketing should be the accurate education of a physician in the side effects and potential benefits of a particular agent. Most doctors, he said, learn about new products from the pharmaceutical industry. The physician who takes the time and effort to go read in depth about a new drug is the exception to the rule, he allowed, and studies support this contention. For that reason, he believed that busy doctors with scant time to dig into the data on their own should be given educational materials that position the treatment in its correct clinical niche. A good sales rep will focus the physician's attention on what are the critical issues around the drug, and then the doctor, hopefully, will take the time to read the package insert and other materials that the drug rep leaves behind, again focusing on what's key. As opposed to simply selling, the industry should help in physicians' education. I'm not trying to pretend that we are not selling, because we are, Watson said. But the ethical company with a good product should be primarily trying to teach the physician how to use it. There is financial self-interest in this approach, of course. With a better understanding of the drug, a physician is more likely to give it a try, Watson said, and try it correctly. We want a good product to be given to the right patient, because if it's not prescribed properly, then either it doesn't work or it has unexpected side effects. And that's the last thing we want, for the patient's sake and because it will turn off the doctor. Some doctors, frankly, are weak-willed wimps, so when a guy comes in and says he has a pain in his knee, and the doctor is scared that the guy is going to go down the road to another doctor if they don't give something, they write a prescription. And you can fill in the blank for whatever is the latest drug that's been advertised, Watson told me. Other doctors, in response to advertisements directed to the public, Watson continued, say to themselves, "Well, he wants this drug. I might have prescribed something else, but it really doesn't make much difference, so I will give him what he wants." It is in this public-driven arena, Watson said, that you see real marketing, the effort by certain pharmaceutical companies to create demand for products that don't merit it based on a medical need. Watson's words brought to mind the expensive pills advertised for indigestion when common antacids are equally effective for most people at a fraction of the cost. Contrary to the branding of many pharmaceuticals, Watson asserts that most generic drugs are equally safe and effective and offer great cost savings. But companies market aggressively against generics and try to mold a doctor's behavior with gifts and perks. I can tell you, if a doctor prescribes an overly expensive brand drug for me because some salesman gave him a Mont Blanc pen, that is not the kind of doctor I would want. Shortly after my conversation with Watson, I spoke with a surgeon I know. As it happened, he was leaving the next day for a skiing trip in Colorado to attend a medical conference. The entire cost of the trip, airfare, hotel, food, and registration for the meeting, was paid for by a company that makes a surgical device he frequently uses in the OR. This was not a Mont Blanc pen. The trip was worth thousands of dollars. I don't think this will influence me to use their product any more than I do, the surgeon insisted. I told him I was skeptical. In fact, he replied, I split my work right down the middle. Half the time I use this company's instruments, and half the time I use their competitors. He laughed, saying that by keeping each one at bay, he would get more perks. What he didn't mention was whether some of the surgeries he performed with either product were necessary in the first place. Sometimes high fees for a particular operation, combined with the largesse of a device company, appear to drive up the number of unnecessary surgeries. Spinal fusion is a prime example. A historical perspective helps in understanding the controversial subject of surgery for chronic back pain. Surgeons have touted a long list of procedures that ultimately proved disappointing, if not ineffective. In the 1950s, many patients with angina and coronary artery disease underwent an operation that involved tying off an artery that runs under the breastbone. At the time, physicians believed that the procedure would increase blood flow to a heart starved of its normal supply by blockages in the coronary arteries. Then, at the end of the decade, a clinical trial showed that patients who had a sham operation did just as well as those who had the real one. Apparently, the placebo effect accounted for the fact that many patients felt better after the surgery. Other once popular procedures resulted from a misunderstanding of the biology of a particular condition. William Halstead pioneered the radical mastectomy in 1895 at the Johns Hopkins Hospital. It became routine therapy for breast cancer. When I was a medical student at Columbia in the early 1970s, no one questioned it. Surgeons throughout the country believed that breast cancer spread in a contiguous, stepwise fashion from the primary tumor, and that the only cure was to remove the entire breast and underlying muscles. By the 1980s, it had become clear that tumor cells can spread throughout the body early in the disease through the lymph channels and blood vessels. A lumpectomy, which involved excising the tumor and preserving the breast, followed by radiation to the affected area, proved as effective as the radical mastectomy in treating the cancer, and was much less mutilating and traumatic for the patient. Spinal fusion may be the radical mastectomy of our time. In 2006, more than 150,000 lower lumbar spine fusions were performed in the United States. The operation involves removing discs from the lower spine and mechanically bracing the vertebrae with metal rods and screws. The procedure is of tremendous benefit to patients with fractured spines or spinal cancer, but these make up a minuscule number of the total cases. More frequently, spinal fusion is performed to alleviate chronic low back pain. There are serious questions about whether the operation is effective and why some doctors perform it. CT and MRI scans are often used to make the case for surgery, but the correlation between damaged or degenerated discs and low back pain is poor. For example, studies have shown that 27% of healthy people over the age of 40 had a herniated disc, 10% had an abnormality of the vertebral facet joints, and 50% had other anatomical changes that appeared significant on CT scans. Yet none of these people had back pain. Similar results were found in a study using MRI scanning. 36% of people over 60 had herniated discs, and some 80-90% of them had significant disc degeneration in the form of narrowing or bulging. Again, despite significant anatomical changes in the lumbar spine, these healthy people had no nagging back pain. For some people, of course, the rupture of a disc coincides with the acute onset of pain. But even then, studies show that surgery is often unnecessary. More than 80% of people will recover with conservative measures, like anti-inflammatory medication, a short period of rest, and then progressive mobilization and physical therapy. A simple operation called a discectomy, shaving off the lip of the disc that has herniated and that presses on the nerve root, can relieve pain more rapidly. Those who wish to avoid an operation can do so, but they may be uncomfortable for a longer time. Each of the various muscles, tendons, bones, joints, and ligaments in the lower back contains sensory nerves that can transmit messages of pain through the spinal cord to the brain. There are also organs in the abdomen and pelvis that, when they become inflamed or diseased, can signal pain in the back. Given all of these structures, the source of the chronic low back pain is often a mystery. Doctors can be hard-pressed to identify why a patient is uncomfortable. How doctors think about a problem like chronic low back pain is heavily influenced by the specialty that they trained in. A research study published in 1994 entitled "Who You See Is What You Get" showed that each group of specialists favored the diagnostic tools of their discipline in evaluating patients. Neurologists called for electromyograms, EMGs, that assess the integrity of the conduction system of nerves. An EMG involves inserting needles into muscles and nerves and then applying a small jolt of electricity. Rheumatologists, who are experts in arthritis and other joint disorders, ordered blood tests called serologies that can identify relatively rare autoimmune disorders that affect the spine. Surgeons requested MRI scans, which reveal the anatomy of the vertebral bones and discs and may suggest a surgical solution. One doctor who sees many patients with chronic low back pain and is an expert in anesthesiology and pain management told me that each approach to diagnosis and treatment is essentially a franchise, and that too many franchises are battling for control. I recognized that he was using a business term as more than a mere metaphor. He pointed out that in medicine, when you do a procedure on a patient, even if it is just sticking a needle into him, the insurance company reimburses you at a much better rate than if you perform a physical examination. So, he said, there is a powerful drive to perform invasive procedures. On the other hand, Dr. Richard Dale, a primary care physician at the University of Washington, who has studied the results of treating thousands of patients with low back pain, emphasized that in most cases, these diagnostic tests are neither informative nor useful in guiding treatment. Research showed that 85% of patients who suffer from low back pain cannot be given a precise diagnosis. The pain is usually vaguely ascribed to strain or sprain in the lumbar region. It turns out that the diagnosis is not critical because the outcomes tend to be similar anyway. With acute low back pain, 90% improve within 2 to 7 weeks without specific therapy. Even with an acute ruptured disc, the prognosis is good, although recovery is usually slower. 80% feel significantly better within 6 weeks without surgery. Over time, the disc retracts, so it no longer presses on the nerves and the inflammation subsides. As noted before, a simple discectomy will make you feel better faster if you have acute sciatica, so some people opt for this procedure. But the rationale for surgery for chronic as opposed to acute low back pain is much less clear. How physicians guide patients with chronic pain, alas, may be significantly influenced by economics. The spine surgeons I spoke with were reluctant to be identified by name out of concern that candid answers would damage their standing in the medical community and reduce patient referrals. So let me call one of these surgeons, Dr. Wheeler. He performs 2 or 3 spinal fusions a week. For many years, Wheeler recommended that his patients with back trouble avoid fusion surgery unless it was absolutely necessary. When the vertebral bones have been dislocated or damaged by diseases that endanger the spinal cord or the nerves. But such conditions are unusual, accounting for less than 2% of all cases of chronic low back pain. Spinal instability is routinely given as a diagnosis to these patients with chronic lower back pain, Wheeler said. It is a term used to justify an operation, and it is a great diagnosis, because it cannot be directly disproved. Like Dr. Foyer, who is a believer in testosterone replacement therapy for older men, several spine surgeons I spoke with were believers in both spinal instability and the need for fusion surgery. They routinely ordered X-rays of the spine and interpreted minor movements in the vertebral bones when flexed or extended as evidence for this diagnosis. But experts in spine surgery, like Wheeler, and in rehabilitation medicine, like Dr. James Rainville at the New England Spine Center, expressed profound skepticism that these minor changes on X-rays could account for chronic pain. Although Wheeler advised patients with long-standing back pain to avoid fusion surgery, he found that considerable forces weighed against his conservative recommendations, particularly when patients had a job-related accident or injury and thus could benefit financially from persistent disability. He told me that one group of 4 neurologists in his community works directly with lawyers. The lawyers refer the patients to these neurologists after an accident or work-related injury associated with back trouble. The neurologists charge up to $1,500 for an EMG and then get another $500 from the attorney for their report. Wheeler averred that in more than 20 years of practice, he had never seen these neurologists read an EMG as negative in accident cases. The neurologists then tell the patients that they have severe disc disease, which can enhance their perception of pain. Moreover, if they do have the surgery, they are told that they don't necessarily have to go back to work afterward. Wheeler said that he is put in a difficult position whenever one of these referring neurologists tells a patient that the EMG or MRI indicates something seriously wrong with the spine. In the past, when Wheeler challenged one of these neurologists, the doctor would counter, "I'm a pro-patient advocate." Of course, most doctors do not behave so egregiously, and most of them believe they advise their patients correctly with the information available from tests and scans. Nonetheless, the current culture of medicine fosters lucrative networks of referrals and procedures, but discourages critical examination of their value. Insurance benefits also favor surgery. Patients usually get greater disability payments if they undergo back surgery. Eventually, Wheeler discovered that nearly all of the patients he turned away were operated on by other surgeons in his area. He decided that if his patients were to have surgery, he might as well be the one to do it. At least he would know that the operation had been competently done. Insurance nearly always reimburses a surgeon at a much higher rate for a fusion operation than for a discectomy. For example, where Wheeler practices, the surgeon's full fee for a simple discectomy is around $5,000, as opposed to some $20,000 for a fusion procedure. The financial incentive tips heavily toward fusion. For the majority of patients with chronic lumbar pain, fusion surgery has no dramatic impact on either their pain or their mobility. Yet many surgeons pay scant attention to the poor results. A prospective trial in Scandinavia compared patients who underwent fusion surgery for chronic low back pain with those who did not. After 2 years, an independent observer rated only 1 out of every 6 patients in the surgical group as having an excellent result, only marginally better than patients who had intensive physical therapy. Despite such a disappointing outcome, some spine surgeons cite the study to support the legitimacy of the operation. In 1993, the Federal Agency for Health Care Policy and Research convened a panel of 23 experts in back pain from a wide spectrum of disciplines: neurology, orthopedics, internal medicine, radiology, chiropractic, rheumatology, psychology, and nursing. The University of Washington's Richard Deo was on the panel. He had recently published a statistical analysis of existing research which suggested that spinal fusion lacked a scientific rationale and that it had a significantly higher rate of complications than simple discectomy. The federal panel was to formulate guidelines for the clinical management of acute low back pain by assessing the scientific evidence concerning its diagnosis and treatment. Although the panel did not discuss insurance coverage, it seemed likely that Medicare and private insurers would consider these guidelines when determining reimbursements. The federal group came under attack almost as soon as it met. The North American Spine Society criticized the panel for not having open deliberations and claimed that the panelists were biased against surgery. The Society lobbied Congress to cut off funding for panels of the Agency for Health Care Policy and Research. Deo told me that the line taken by the opponents was, "These guys are anti-surgery, anti-fusion." But, he insisted, "We really had no axe to grind. Our aim was to critically examine the evidence and outcomes of these common medical practices." After the November 1994 congressional elections, which featured a dramatic shift from a Democratic to a Republican majority, the newly configured House of Representatives was receptive to the accusations against the panel. Although the American Medical Association, the American College of Physicians, and the American Hospital Association all tried to save the Health Care Policy Agency, the House zeroed out its budget. Then the battle moved to the Senate. Although the agency ultimately survived, Congress cut its funds drastically. A company that manufactures devices used in fusion surgery sought a court injunction to block publication of the panel's findings. The guidelines that were eventually published emphasized conservative measures like physical therapy, but the controversy surrounding the panel tainted its credibility, and its recommendations have had little impact on surgical practice. While one spine surgeon I spoke with still defends his actions against the panel, even he admitted that fusion operations have proliferated in the United States. He pointed out that when he began his training more than two decades ago, only a handful of fellowships in spine surgery existed. Now there are more than 80. Each year, more and more specialists are being trained, and those specialists naturally look for opportunities to use their training. The technology has also developed rapidly. New sorts of screws, rods, and cages, as well as other devices, can be inserted into the spine. These instruments are aggressively marketed and generate high profit margins for both the manufacturers and the hospitals that use them. I spoke with a surgeon after his return from a meeting on spine surgery held at a luxurious resort. As with my surgeon friend mentioned earlier, the entire trip was paid for by a company that manufactures the hardware he uses in performing fusions. He claimed that the perk would not alter his practice, but also affirmed that he was a believer in fusion surgery. "My outcomes are better than anything in the published literature," he said. But when pressed, he admitted that long-term follow-ups are rare, and that he has not participated in any randomized prospective controlled trials comparing fusion surgery with conservative measures such as physical therapy. When the government won't stop unnecessary procedures, when corporate interests push for them, and when doctors come to believe in them, the only institutions that might stem the tide of needless surgery are the medical schools and their affiliated hospitals. And indeed, many hospitals do try to disentangle medicine from corporate influence. The Journal of the American Medical Association published a paper in January 2006 that got considerable attention. In it, academic physicians from Columbia and Harvard recommended that doctors begin to police themselves against untoward influence by the pharmaceutical industry. No medical advance can be made without a partnership with the private sector, whether it be the development of a drug or a new implantable device. A free enterprise economy presupposes that a business will try to gain as large a share of the market as possible and maximize profits. On the other hand, the decisions a doctor makes about his patients should be free from any thought of personal financial gain. The authors of the JAMA article went so far as to assert that even apparently trivial gifts could subtly influence a physician. They argue that in the psychology of gift-giving, consciously or subconsciously, one feels obligated to give back. Sometimes, though hardly always, the giving back may be at the patient's expense. Many hospitals and universities, as well as medical journals, now require that physicians disclose their financial relationships with businesses. Some of these relationships involve consulting, others funding for research or educational activities. The purpose of disclosure is to make public the relationship and alert the patient or the reader of the journal to potential prejudice or bias. But the authors of the JAMA article argued that such disclosure is not enough. They pointed to Wall Street, where stock analysts have inappropriately promoted the shares of certain companies despite financial links between the analysts' employers and the companies concerned. Indeed, such disclosure may work against its purpose. Patients or readers may believe that disclosure frees the physician or scientist from potential bias associated with personal gain, when in fact, disclosure does no such thing. Dr. Thomas Stossel, an eminent hematologist at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, wrote a rebuttal in Forbes arguing that relationships with industry are essential to medical progress, and to sever or severely strain these relationships would, in the end, hurt patients in need of new drugs. In appraising potential conflicts of interest, the hospital where I work distinguishes between clinical care and laboratory research. Laboratory researchers are encouraged to have relationships with industry, since these relationships are essential to developing cures for currently incurable diseases. On the other hand, the risk that personal financial gain could color clinical thinking is considered too great to allow doctors to test drugs in experimental protocols if they are consultants to a pharmaceutical company or device manufacturer. The restrictions do not extend as far as the JAMA article proposed, so personal perks like dinners at expensive restaurants or honoraria for speaking at conferences, given to doctors in the form of educational grants by the conference's sponsor, are still permitted. Most hospitals and medical schools today find themselves in this gray zone. It is unlikely that in the near future personal financial gain will be extracted from certain clinical decisions. Several spine surgeons told me they would not participate in a trial comparing simple discectomy with fusion surgery, because fusion surgery is a main source of their income and because they are convinced of its value. These were the obstacles that Dr. James Weinstein at Dartmouth Medical School faced in trying to launch a national study. Weinstein, an orthopedic surgeon and a leading expert in back pain, told me that the way doctors approach treatment of chronic lumbar complaints needs radical improvement. Patients, he said, must be given unbiased information about what is known and not known about back pain and the various ways of treating it. Instead of informed consent, Weinstein advocates what is called informed choice, a comprehensive understanding of all the options and their possible risks and benefits. Informed choice means, in part, learning how different doctors think about a particular medical problem and how science, tradition, financial incentives, and personal bias mold that thinking. There is no single source for all of this information about each disorder, so a patient and family should ask the doctor whether a proposed treatment is standard or whether different specialists recommend different approaches and why. Laypeople also should inquire about how time-tested a new treatment is. Karen Delgado is a model in this regard. She infuses common sense into the scientific results from clinical trials. She is unafraid to question custom and tradition. She sees medicine as a calling and not a business. And she avoids financial temptations that could subtly guide her practice. Patients often come to her after reading newspaper articles or watching TV reports that feature physicians' testimonials about results from a research study or an alleged breakthrough. That may be what they believe, Delgado tells her patients, but now let's talk about what we know and what we don't know. Chapter 10. In Service of the Soul. Memorial Hospital is a brown brick building that rises 21 stories and occupies the entire block between 67th and 68th Streets on York Avenue on the east side of Manhattan. Connected to the hospital is the Sloan Kettering Institute, a warren of steel and glass structures that house research laboratories. In 2005, more than 21,000 patients were admitted to the hospital, and there were 445,000 outpatient visits. Nearly 16,000 surgeries were performed, and 110,000 radiation treatments were administered. Each day, some 9,000 physicians, nurses, psychologists, social workers, laboratory technologists, and support personnel arrive to care for people with cancer. This massive enterprise can be traced back to the plight of a single young woman, Elizabeth Daschle, who fell ill during the summer of 1890. In his wonderful book, A Commotion in the Blood, Stephen S. Hall recounts her case. Her problem began when she took a train trip across the United States. During the journey, her hand was caught between two seats of a Pullman car. It soon became swollen and painful. She assumed it was infected. The pain persisted after she returned home to New Jersey. In September, she consulted William Coley, a 28-year-old surgeon in private practice in New York City. Dr. Coley was uncertain about the diagnosis. Still hoping it was an infection, he made a small incision below the joint that connects the little finger to the back of the hand. But only a few drops of pus fell from the lanced area. Over the next 3 months, Coley saw Dashiell regularly, determined to diagnose her underlying problem and relieve her growing pain. After consulting with several senior surgeons at New York Hospital, he decided that he needed to probe the swollen tissues more deeply. In October 1890, Dashiell underwent surgery. Coley scraped firm, gristle-like material off her tendons and bones. But the procedure failed to yield an answer and gave her only temporary respite from the pain. In early November, Coley performed a biopsy and finally made a diagnosis: sarcoma. A sarcoma is a cancer of the connective tissue, developing from bone, tendon, or muscle. Coley desperately wanted to save Dashiell and attempted to do so by amputating the young woman's arm just below the elbow. But it was too late. Over the ensuing months, the sarcoma spread to her face, breasts, and abdomen. Her pain became so severe that only high doses of morphine could control it. Elizabeth Dashiell died at home at 7 a.m. on January 23, 1891. Dr. Coley was at her bedside. Several months later, he presented Dashiell's case to his surgical colleagues at the New York Academy of Medicine. He concluded his presentation with these remarks: "A disease that can attack a person in perfect health, in the full vigor of early maturity, and in some insidious, mysterious way, within a few months, destroy life, is surely a subject important enough to demand our best thought and continued study." Dashiell would have been just another young woman tragically dying with an incurable cancer, except that one of her closest friends was John D. Rockefeller, Jr., the only son of the founder of Standard Oil. Rockefeller had met Dashiell through her older brother, and he grew so fond of her that he came to think of Elizabeth as his adopted sister. Rockefeller was shocked by Dashiell's death. Several years later, he continued a program of philanthropy that his family has sustained for generations and that resulted in the founding of Memorial Hospital. Dr. Stephen Nimer is a physician at Memorial who cares for his patients in the tradition of William Coley, devoting to them his best thought and continued study. On a recent spring morning, Dr. Nimer walked down the corridor of the 11th floor of the hospital and entered a conference room to begin his teaching rounds. He is a hematologist who specializes in leukemia, lymphoma, and other malignant disorders of the bone marrow. Nimer stands just shy of 6 feet and has a prominent widow's peak and an oval face that frames his rimless glasses. He likes to joke that he is one of the few MIT graduates who went there to play hockey. That day, Nimer was dressed in a spotless white coat, starched blue shirt, and perfectly knotted silk tie. He noted with satisfaction that he was precisely on time. The hematology fellow and the senior resident on the clinical service were waiting. There was a new case for the fellow to present, and after exchanging pleasantries, he began. "Max Bornstein is a 59-year-old gentleman who had a large cell lymphoma successfully treated 2 years ago and now has MDS. MDS stands for myelodysplastic syndrome, a conglomerate term of Greek roots that signifies injury to the primitive cells of the bone marrow, the stem cells. The injured stem cells grow in a stunted, disorderly way and fail to produce enough blood. In Bornstein's case, it was the chemotherapy that cured his lymphoma 2 years before that had injured his marrow stem cells. His white blood cell count is 1,900, his platelets 74,000, and his hemoglobin 9.8, the fellow said. I calculated all of his parameters, including his marrow findings. His calculated score puts him at intermediate 2 risk on the IPSS. Based on his score, I would just transfuse him and not do anything beyond such supportive measures." Nimer's face tightened. "I'm not interested in where he scores on the international prognostic scoring system," he said to the fellow. "Well, we could use a different scoring system based on the World Health Organization classification." "You are missing the point," Nimer interrupted. It was a point that was all too often missed, and one that Nimer sees as essential in training the next generation of hematologists. "But he has IPSS intermediate risk 2 disease," the fellow said. "Wait a minute," Nimer said. He turned to the resident and asked, "Did the fellow just say this man had IPSS intermediate risk 2 disease?" The resident looked confused. "Yes," he answered. "But what's wrong with that?" Nimer shot back, then turned to the fellow. "Did you really mean to say that?" "Well, why not?" the fellow replied. "Do you agree that the patient has MDS due to prior chemotherapy?" Nimer asked, beginning to lead the fellow down a different path. "Yes." "Then you should know that the IPSS classification excludes patients who have had prior therapy as a cause of their MDS." Nimer paused. "Okay, that's my first point. But more importantly, do you need to know the IPSS classification in order to take care of any patient?" "Well, we calculate the IPSS all the time," the fellow said. "Yes, that's true. But last week this man's white blood cell count was 3,200, and in 7 days it fell to 1,900. His platelets fell from 105,000 to 74,000. So I don't really care about the IPSS at this point. I know this is a man who is headed for big trouble, a man who's rapidly deteriorating and needs treatment right away. Not simple supportive measures like transfusion. Treatment right away." As Nimer later explained to me, he routinely encounters young physicians who relinquish their own thinking and instead look to classification schemes and algorithms to think for them. In this instance, the fellow was fitting Mr. Bornstein onto a grid based on his blood counts and bone marrow picture. When Nimer challenged him, the fellow's response was to invoke another classification scheme. "It's a static way of looking at people," Nimer said. "Strictly speaking, it's correct. But clinically speaking, it's wrong. The proliferation of these boilerplate schemes," Nimer believes, "has caused doctors to become so wedded to generic profiles that they ignore the individual characteristics of the patient. This man doesn't come out looking bad on this classification system," Nimer continued, "which is why the fellow suggested supportive measures rather than aggressive treatment. But, in fact, viewing Bornstein's case in this way was an illusion, an artifact of the schema, because the classification system fails to take into account the course of the person's disease, the rate of fall in his blood counts. Based on his trajectory, Bornstein's blood counts soon would plummet to perilous levels. He likely would die from an infection or hemorrhage before any treatment could take effect. Scoring schemes are proliferating in all branches of medicine. They can be useful ways of organizing clinical data, providing a structure to assess complex and heterogeneous disorders. But they are also very seductive. It is not always clear when to treat a person with highly toxic and potentially lethal chemotherapy. In this instance, Nimer recommended a bone marrow transplant, arguably the most drastic therapy available in hematology and oncology, a therapy that can cure or kill. Deciding whether a patient needs a marrow transplant and when to perform it is a profound responsibility. Fitting a patient into a spot on a grid that doesn't dictate a harsh therapy, like a marrow transplant, comes as a relief for the physician as well as the patient. But it would be a grave mistake. Relying on schemas also suits the hectic pace of today's clinical care. Bornstein was just one of dozens of patients the fellow would see in the course of a week. Algorithms and grids gave him shortcuts around the onerous process of assessing each of these dozens of complex cases. Nimer wanted to push him toward a difficult but necessary type of thinking about every patient. In addition to his work with patients, Nimer oversees a large research program studying malignant blood diseases like lymphoma and leukemia. I believe that my thinking in the clinic is helped by having a laboratory. If you do an experiment 2 times and you don't get results, then it doesn't make sense to do it the same way 3rd time. You have to ask yourself, what am I missing? How should I do it differently the next time? It is the same iterative process in the clinic. If you are taking care of someone and he is not getting better, then you have to think of a new way to treat him, not just keep giving him the same therapy. You also have to wonder whether you are missing something. This seemingly obvious set of statements is actually a profound realization, because it is much easier both psychologically and logistically for a doctor to keep treating a serious disease with a familiar therapy even when the disease is not responding. In hematology and oncology, diseases often are difficult to cure. Specialists sometimes say privately, "It's a bad disease," meaning that it is complex and often resistant to textbook therapies. But repeatedly affirming how severe a certain type of lymphoma usually is, how aggressive a certain leukemia can be, has a subtle psychological effect. The mantra, "it's a bad disease," can shift the burden of thinking off the specialist. Instead of struggling to come at the malady from a different angle, seeking its vulnerable point by adding other drugs or customizing a regimen, the physician, in essence, surrenders. This surrender is not conscious, but an astute patient can pick up on the fact that his doctor is sticking with the same treatment, not taking the risk of devising a novel, individual approach when the condition is not improving, because it's a bad disease. When I was a fellow in training at UCLA, some of the senior attending physicians invoked this mantra, and I found myself repeating it with a guilty sense of relief. It acted as a buffer against the fear of failure, a fear that even an accomplished physician, which I was not, carries within himself. It is healthy and beneficial to invest your ego in healing your patient's disease. But when your ego overshadows that goal, there lies danger. "I tell patients that I am going to do everything possible to help them," Nimer said, "and that means that I am also setting myself up to fail." Failure is something that physicians deeply dislike. This became apparent to me when I researched outcomes of surgery for prostate cancer. Different surgeons reported a wide range of postoperative impotence and incontinence. Although the individual skill of the surgeon may account for some of this variation, as I probed some more, it appeared to be largely a function of which patients the surgeon chose to operate on. Some surgeons turned down difficult cases involving large, aggressive cancers. Others refused to operate on patients with serious medical problems like diabetes, even though surgery was their best option to eradicate the cancer. Such patients are more prone to nerve damage and thus to impotence. "I tell my patients that the more aggressive the disease, the more aggressive the treatment," Nimer said. "And because it is a bad disease, the doctor should increase his efforts rather than retreat. Sometimes, even very bad diseases can be cured." George Franklin was a successful independent investor with a cavernous apartment on Park Avenue and a weekend house in the Hudson River Valley. He had traveled to remote corners of the world, hunting and fishing and enjoying the richness of nature. I was a friend of his sister-in-law, and she told me he had the energetic spirit of a Theodore Roosevelt. About 15 years ago, Franklin was languishing in a Manhattan hospital with a high fever and low blood cell counts. His internist was a man from his social set, advanced in years and, by his own admission, perplexed as to the cause of Franklin's problem. The hematologist who consulted on his case failed to make a diagnosis. She thought he might have aplastic anemia, a disorder where the marrow blood cells are scant. I prevailed upon George Franklin to see a specialist I knew at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and in short order, the correct diagnosis was made: T-cell lymphoma. Lymphoma is a cancer of the lymphocytes, a type of blood cell. There are 2 major types of lymphocytes, B and T. Most lymphomas originate in the B cells. A smaller fraction affect T cells and are notoriously aggressive. T-cell lymphomas are, in the parlance of the corridor, bad diseases. George Franklin was initially treated using a combination chemotherapy regimen called ICE for ifosfamide, carboplatin, and etoposide. It is a difficult treatment. Franklin suffered the expected complications, mouth blisters and diarrhea. He stoically allowed that he didn't like the treatment, but he was even more unhappy when informed that it had hardly made a dent in his disease. He wanted another approach and another doctor. I suggested Stephen Nimer. Some hematologists would have given Franklin more cycles of ICE, hoping that the cumulative effect would send the T-cell lymphoma into remission. But Nimer believed that the lack of any improvement, despite full doses of the regimen, demanded an immediate and radical change in therapy. Nimer outlined a strategy with Franklin. They would try different drugs in the hope that one or more would reduce the amount of lymphoma in his body to the point where he could undergo a bone marrow transplant. Because Franklin did not have a matched donor, Nimer would harvest the stem cells from Franklin's own bone marrow, treat him with what would be lethal amounts of chemotherapy, and then rescue him with his own stem cells. "It scares me," Franklin said to Nimer, "but I really don't have a choice, do I?" Nimer replied that everyone always has a choice, but that this was the most rational way to proceed, and the only chance of a cure. The way a physician phrases his recommendations can powerfully sway a patient's choices. For example, by phrasing results in the positive, patients are more likely to accept the recommendation. "We have a 30% chance of improvement with this approach," triggers a different reaction than, "There is a 70% chance of failure and death," although the two statements are clinically equivalent. Also, some patients may interpret the word improvement to mean cure, when in fact it can indicate only a temporary shrinkage of a cancer. Patients also respond differently when data are presented in percentages rather than absolute numbers. For example, an elderly man in my community called to ask my opinion about treatment for a recently diagnosed colon cancer. The cancer was relatively limited and hadn't spread to any vital organs. He had multiple medical problems,